Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
UK Tech Weekly Podcast.
She came from Greece, she had a thirst for knowledge. She studied sculpture at St. Martin's College, and that's where I caught her ear with the UK Tech Weekly Podcast, the UK's premier audio upholstery, giving you a nice sit-down every Friday. The UK Tech Weekly Podcast is an infotainment cake baked by the editors of PC Advisor, Techworld, Macworld UK, and Computerworld UK. You can find us on Acast, on SoundCloud, on iTunes, and pretty much everywhere from which you source podcasts. Every Friday we hold an audio inauguration, making unintelligible audio speeches to massive audio crowds of unspecified sizes and our former audio enemies as we facilitate the peaceful transition of audio power from our mouths to your ears in order to bring you no more than 40 minutes of informed tech chat on the hot tech topics of the past 7 days. Please subscribe to our podcast, review it if you can and give it 5 stars, and tell your friends all about it. I'm Matt Egan, Editorial Director of IDG UK. And today I'm delighted to be joined in conversation by your brother from another mother, Dominic Preston, Staff Writer of Macworld UK.
Hi.
Your sister, as you would only have wished her, Tamlin McGee, Online Editor of ComputerWorldUK.com.
Hello.
And your short-term stepfather that no one really talks about anymore, but who does occasionally turn up to family occasions, often somewhat the worse for wear and short of cash. Henry Burrell, Senior Staff Writer of PC Advisor.
On the head.
This week we are talking Samsung, survivalists and evil. Come with me. I'm in the phone booth, it's the one across the hall, because my Samsung smartphone has yet to arrive. Henry Burrell, what's not happening very soon in a galaxy that now feels very far, far away?
Seems. It's nearly February, so that means it's nearly Mobile World Congress. So all of us tech nerds are waiting for new phones. We'll be going out there. But Samsung won't be there for the first time announcing a new Galaxy phone since 2014.
Okay.
So we had lots of fires that they were putting out, both PR fires and actual fires from the Galaxy Note 7. And they are trying their damnedest this year to go past that. So there's a couple of things. Yeah, the Galaxy S5, S6 and S7 were all basically the biggest thing at Mobile World Congress.
Yeah.
And now they've confirmed that it won't be revealed at the show this year.
The S8.
The S8, yes.
Have they said when it will be launched?
Yeah, so their well-named mobile chief, he's called DJ Ko. he isn't a real DJ, but it will be and the end of March announcements. They've basically just bumped it back a month.
Okay.
So most people are probably thinking, why didn't they just announce it in February so we can all see it? But they're just treading very carefully now. They can't afford any mistakes with their next major release. And this phone is even more important now because of that.
Well, it might also be, I guess, that they want to announce it and then it immediately be available.
Yeah, you're probably right there, because they're talking about a late April release. So there'll be less of a gap between announcement and basically trying to get people to buy what is deemed to be a pretty important phone.
What are we expecting from the Galaxy S8?
It depends if you care about iterative updates to mobile phones, but obviously we do.
I certainly care about those.
You've got the S7, I believe, S7 Edge. So
I do, yes.
It's going to be a little bit different from that. And I think, I mean, it is getting a bit nitpicky, but since the iPhone came out, you could kind of argue that it's the same design for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
The fingerprint thing is on the front, the home button, whatever. So the Samsung is probably going to have what's called an infinity display. That's probably a bit of branding there. But they'll just basically, there'll be hardly any bezel.
Right.
It'll be
huge the glass screen goes edge to edge, essentially.
Yeah, and then probably at the top and bottom as well.
Okay.
Move the fingerprint sensor to the back. There were lots of rumours that they'd somehow try and build that technology into the screen, but they can't. And yeah, it's going to have an iris scanner, which I still think is slightly unnecessary piece of tech to put on a phone. The Note 7 had one, I believe. And they'll whack USB-C on there as well.
Okay.
But that's a whole other minefield of standardization that won't.
I mean, making the display edge to edge in that way will have the effect of making it look different in a good way, like the edge does actually to an extent. I mean, that edge of mine is brilliant, but I smash it about every 6 weeks because that whole screen thing is so delicate. But it does make it look really nice, which kind of matters if you're trying to encourage people to buy something.
And the advantage Samsung does have in that way is that they've got their first over their rivals. They tend to do it best. Apart from when they catch fire. And it just means that you have a phone that is smaller than an iPhone but has a bigger screen.
Yeah, which is pretty compelling, really.
Yeah.
It does make the iPhones next to them look a bit toy town. Kind
of thing. A little bit. I know what you mean. But then the other news that came with that around the same time, the same chief announced that they will continue with the Note brand as well.
Right, so there will be a Galaxy Note 8.
Yes. Not at the same time, probably not this year, unless they're going to be really ballsy. Yeah. But I just didn't expect that. I thought that they would probably, I mean, they killed the Note 7 after, they should have just done that straight away. Yeah. They tried to re-release it.
Still fairly quick, I would say. I mean, I can't recall another manufacturer like killing a flagship line that quickly.
Yeah, I was trying to think of anything we could compare it to, and the only thing I could think of, which now just looks like a tiny blip, but it's when the iPhone 4 came out and some people, by basically holding it,
those bumper things.
Yeah, so they kind of just sidestepped that and just politely offered you a bumper and kept going.
But I mean, they weren't exploding and, you know, getting banned on flights and...
Not being able to hear is bad, but it is actually better than having something explode next to your face.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good way to live your life.
So how is Samsung doing in general, would we say, taking all this on board?
We talked about this before on the pod. I remember Jim Martin, editor of PCA, saying it wouldn't matter. People will get over it. And at the time, I kind of disagreed. I thought, no, this is major. But I mean, unless you did have a phone explode next to your face, I don't know. I think Samsung are big enough to come back from it. I think if they wisely waited to make sure it's going to be brilliant and not explode, I think they'll be fine.
Do you think that Samsung will continue to be kind of the flagship Android phone? I know Google's bringing out nice phones now.
Yeah.
As well, but
yeah, that was...
I remember when Android first started being a thing, HTC held that for a long time, and then it kind of... LG had a bit of a go, then it was Samsung was the nice Android phone you could get.
Samsung seemed to have like that sort of market dominance.
They've got scale, haven't they? They're an OEM for other brands as well, so they can make lots of these things. And HTC and LG have both made great products, and still make great products, actually. Mm. The problem is they don't sell enough of them, so they don't make money out of it. HTC's like always hand-to-mouth, desperately trying to sort of find... That's why they're interested in things like VR and stuff like that, because it's just a low-margin business and they don't have huge scale. Mm. LG's an interesting one to watch. The G6, which we know is coming this year, will be a very interesting phone, because a bit like Samsung, they do make a lot of the components themselves, particularly the displays, which is what's critical.
Mm. Yeah.
Samsung's just... huge and makes great products.
Yeah, we're expecting the G6 at Mobile World Congress, and it's my gut feeling that it'd be wise for them just to do an excellent phone that is probably quite similar to Samsung. Mm. We've seen some pictures of it again, like the screen is pretty much edge to edge, and they've tried to be a bit quirky with the last two phones. Like the G4 was kind of had a ceramic back, and you could get a leather one.
Yeah,
and it was
a
bit bent. It was kind of like curved, but like a sort of banana shape. And then the G5 had all these mods you could take in and out of it, but they only released about four, and no one bought it.
And the G3 was the one which I think you maybe recall. And G2 and G3, Tamlin, were the ones that were hands down the best phones on the market at the time.
Yeah,
but I don't think it did them a huge amount of good. They were the first people to have true HD on display.
Yes.
Which is not something you need particularly, but again, I had the G3 because as soon as you saw that next to another phone, the kind of magpie in you is like, I want that.
Yeah.
That's the one that looks nice.
It definitely did that. And then, like you say, HTC just doesn't have the scale anymore. And they've just released a phone, what's coming out soon. It's called the HTC U Ultra, which seems like a very weird phone to me.
Sounds like a political organisation.
The HDU Ultras. It's just such a strange phone. Chris Martin has had a hands-on with it, and I don't know, he quite liked it, but for me, they're a company that can't get away with doing things that other companies can. Yeah. They're releasing a phone that is below flagship spec, doesn't have a headphone jack. It has like a weird second screen at the top of the other screen where all your notifications gather. It's very weird. And it's like more expensive than the S7 Edge.
Gonna struggle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little bit.
It's a tough sell.
But it's not the only brand that we'll see trying to make a comeback this year. We're expecting at Mobile World Congress as well to see a Nokia.
Yeah, this is really interesting because, like, I mean, certainly going from our web traffic, people are hugely interested in this.
Yeah.
And we understand that they've had a lot of registrations before it goes on sale.
Yeah, they have. So they're doing the same thing that BlackBerry's doing by keeping the brand but outsourcing the manufacturing to another company. So it's going to be a phone made by HMD, but with Nokia all over it. It's the first Android Nokia, which just come out in China. Just sold out. It's hundreds of thousands of pre-sale. And it's £200, I think.
Ooh,
wow. So it's got a Snapdragon 430, which
one of the great processors.
My fellow nerds will appreciate for its processing, but it's mid-range. Okay.
Mid-range is all you need, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. If you've got RAM and you don't want to, like, you know, record a blockbuster on it, then you'll be all right. But I think MWC, we're actually hopefully going to see a flagship spec Nokia phone. Running Android.
See, Nokia is one of those companies that could do a like below flagship spec device as well, because it's got that name recognition that people would just buy it.
Yeah, and it's not been long since those Microsoft Nokia phones were out as well, the Lumia.
Well, that's the interesting thing. What did Microsoft buy?
Yeah. No one really knows. it did buy Nokia the handset division. It laid a lot of people off, and it made some decent phones, and then but then they rebranded it and tried to make it a mid-range.
The Windows phones were really good, but it just seems odd that now, because this is not Windows, this is not Microsoft, this is Nokia, the old company.
Yeah, it's HMD, which is another Finnish company.
Now owns the brand.
Yes.
When Nokia was sort of going down the pan and firing a bunch of people, and just before it got sold off to Microsoft, it was still performing really well in the BRICS countries. Yeah. So I wonder if it can sort of take that territory.
Yeah, completely. Well, that's the thing that we often don't notice. So, like, for instance, what's the phone company that Lenovo bought?
Motorola,
right. So the principal reason for that is because, again, Motorola has huge name recognition in, what's the BRICS countries? Brazil, India,
China.
Okay. But also sub-Saharan Africa. Mm-hmm. All these places where actually the real growth in terms of people who don't have smartphones is going to come, not least because there isn't great infrastructure for traditional broadband, if you like. So the way people are getting online is through smart devices. And companies like Apple are nowhere in those countries.
No.
Quite deliberately, actually. Apple sells the iPhone in Brazil, and it's like the equivalent of £1,000 because it's not worth it to them to sell it into that territory for less than that. That's their model. Whereas these big, large-scale phone manufacturers, their game is to try and win those new users, I guess, in what we might call sort of the, not the developing world, but the
emerging economies.
The emerging economies.
Yeah, like Nokia is targeting China and also India. This is where that Android phone will do very well.
Yeah. How interesting. Just quickly, going back to Samsung, would everybody here buy a Samsung phone after the Note?
I had the Galaxy S6 and it was very good apart from the battery life. I've since got an iPhone, but I would go back to it. I think the S7's a great phone, and it hasn't put me off, actually, no.
Guys?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not one for getting phones as they're released because I think they're just ludicrously expensive.
Yeah, it's
anyway.
Like buying a new car. Yeah, it's just not the smart thing to do.
I would definitely look into it down the line, probably. Definitely, probably.
Yeah, similar. Just give it a little bit of time, make sure they're not exploding at people.
Yeah.
And assuming that's all good, yeah. I'll be up for it.
Cool. Okay, let's go around the room. Galaxy Quest or Galactic Mess? Henry Burrell.
I've got to go with Galaxy Quest.
Tamlyn McGee.
Galaxy Quest.
Dominic.
Definitely Galaxy Quest.
Wow, everyone loves Samsung. Okay, cool. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about maniacs. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine because I am mega rich and slightly mad. Tamlyn McGee. Know anywhere I can get a gross of tins of beans and a few bottles of water, eh?
Well, you'd probably be best off not robbing a fortified compound belonging to Silicon Valley billionaires.
Duly noted.
Because there was a big article out in the New Yorker saying that As we might be aware, there's something called the Prepper Movement in the US, whereby paranoid people buy up stocks of gold and, you know, build bomb shelters and so on because they're worried about the end of the world. But what's different about this story is that a lot of the ultra-rich people in Silicon Valley and San Francisco are doing it, worried right. about some kind of cataclysmic world-ending event, whether that's political, economic, or natural disasters.
And they are preparing for this by...
by buying ridiculous compounds, sometimes in private islands, sometimes in abandoned missile silos, and fortifying and weaponizing them. And you have to wonder, like, they're just waiting for it. They can't wait to use their toys, can they?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing that would immediately concern me, is that these people, I mean, I dare say you'll give us some examples in a second, but if these people are fantastically wealthy and also they're wealthy from tech, so they're quite influential, and their plan is to check out and leave us to it, that is somewhat concerning. It's just they're not fully engaged in the world.
I have a friend of mine who was a tech reporter, he's not anymore, who's been working on a similar story for some time, and he was always, taken aback by how negative the view of these VCs in particular was of the current political climate. And I'd say there's potentially semi-convincing arguments for it. Maybe they've got the foresight to understand that politically the world is looking in pretty bad shape right now.
Well, we're probably closer to the end of what you might call the Western Empire than we are to the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think...
I mean, I've got two small children. I'd rather they could at least grow up without having to buy a private island. How much does a private island cost? I haven't planned for this at all.
I'm more keen on the abandoned missile silo myself. I think that's where I'd go.
I think you can...
Anything that sounds like a level in GoldenEye.
Exactly.
So, I don't know, Larry Ellison owns a private... Well, it's actually an inhabited Hawaiian island, but he owns it.
Right.
I think that's set him back just short of a billion or so, but don't quote me on that.
Yeah, there isn't much that Larry Ellison doesn't own.
No, he owns a fighter jet as well.
Yeah.
But he's got the biggest yacht, hasn't he? Which is kind of the...
so he says.
Dick on the table. US.
Is this just an end result of having so much money that you just don't have anything to worry about, so you just create something slightly apocalyptic that you can afford to worry about?
I mean, it does seem to me there seems to be an element of role play about this.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, these people can afford to splurge on ridiculous sci-fi compounds and geek out about it. But as well, like, I don't know, there have been TED Talks for years now from very rich people who say, you know, if we don't look at distributing wealth a little bit more equally, they're going to come out for us with the pitchforks. So maybe you can kind of see where they're coming from.
Yeah, I mean, there's some sense in that. It's always galling when that comes from an extremely rich person, though, isn't it?
It is.
Rich enough to say it.
Yeah.
I think there's something in the American psyche, actually, you know, in particular about this, because there is a grand history, particularly in, you know, California is the Old West, of this idea of it being your duty almost to be independent and sort of not anti-government, but anti-society, where everyone...
self-reliant almost.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, yeah. I'm not saying it's the same thing, but a lot of this idea of you know, the right to bear arms, it relates to something similar, which is something we probably don't fully recognise in this country, given that we've never had that kind of revolution. This idea that, you know, self-reliance is the term, I guess.
I mean, there is a big crossover. Well, there seems to be a big crossover between these preppers and Burning Man, the festival in the States as well.
Right.
Which in recent years is the attendance of Silicon Valley sorts has just skyrocketed. Mm. You know, the whole ethos of that festival being that, you know, you look after each other, but first of all, you look after yourself and you're self-reliant. I mean, my instinct is, so that San Francisco is a strange place anyway, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of an enclave of the ultra-rich. So if you get enough of these people in a room and start chatting paranoid thoughts to them, like, this sort of thing's bound to happen, isn't it?
Well, San Francisco, especially, because it is an enclave of the super-rich.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
But it's also a place where people live and have lived for several generations, and that classic thing of them now not being able to afford to, I mean, it's more expensive than London.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's a really odd place for exactly that reason, because the Absolutely. Kind of the culture is just strange, because it is, if you're not super rich, you're incredibly poor because you're living next door to super rich people.
Yeah. Maybe it's just a logical conclusion of, you know, driving past a makeshift tent city on the way to your enormously expensive Silicon Valley.
Or driving past in an Uber that is driven by one of the many hundreds of Uber drivers who work in San Francisco and sleep in their cars all week because they live somewhere else in California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's absolutely no chance they can earn a living and sleep in a bed at night. Yeah.
I mean, I lived there for a year and I definitely saw the poor side of the city. And I just didn't see the rich side of it. You know they're there. Mm. But, yeah. I mean, in terms of appearances, these people do hide themselves away, the rich. And they, yeah, you see the depravity that is on the streets of San Francisco. And there's nothing you can do about it. And the fact that all these tech billionaires are trying to run a... I don't know. it's a very confusing, frustrating thing, especially like having seen it. Because I just don't know where any of these rich people are.
Yeah. Did you
apart from on their private islands?
Did you? What's the prison museum? It's brilliant.
Alcatraz.
Did you go to Alcatraz?
Prison museum. Yeah, it was good.
Larry Ellison lives in it now.
Yeah. I like Alcatraz.
Yeah, it's cool.
But like, I don't know. It also speaks somewhat of the egotism of these people, because if you look at people like Peter Thiel, who I mention all the time on the podcast, and Zuckerberg and so on, they've all got big egos on them. And, you know, one of the guys that the New Yorker focuses on in this article is the Reddit co-founder, whose name is, as I scroll, excuse me, Steve Huffman, who said that he presumes that if the shit did hit the fan, as he called it, he wouldn't be a slave, he'd be a leader. And it's like, you know, nice. What do you think of yourself?
Why is this sort of story exclusive to tech billionaires then? Why aren't like oil barons getting worried about the uprising?
I mean, maybe they are, but it's kind of more of an alluring story because tech's so, I guess, egotistical and kind of ingrained in everything.
It's a little bit the new oil as well, isn't it? In the sense that in the 80s especially, you know, when Dallas went from being a small backwater to being this huge, shiny town, it was because people, some of them extremely talented, many of them very kind of brave, albeit with other people's money and resources, some of them just fantastically lucky, got unbelievably rich compared to the people who lived around them.
Yeah.
And it created this kind of, you know, literal Wild West situation where the gap between rich and poor was huge. And that's kind of what's happened in tech. Some of these people are, you know, arguably geniuses. At the same time, some of them just did a very smart thing at the right time and just caught a wave. Zuckerberg's a classic example of that. He's managed his business far more impressively than the initial creation of Facebook. And it just happens to have caught this wave, and now it's a hugely successful thing. You'd almost be mentally ill if you didn't convince yourself that you deserved that. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise you'd have to live the rest of your life thinking, well, you know, somehow I pulled the ladder up through luck.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And that breeds its own kind of paranoia, I guess.
I think that it's easy to kind of sneer at these people mentioned in this article, especially the guy who said he's taking up archery to defend himself. but it's easy to sneer because, you know, their lives are so far detached from ours. But at the same time, it shows a certain strand of, I guess, foresight, that they're anticipating kind of seismic change. Mm. And it might not go the way they expect it to go, with, you know, pitchforks at the door and so on. But the fact that enough people are doing this for it to be a trend in some circles in one of the richest areas, the richest country in the world, signifies something, I think.
Yeah. So, so guys, what would you pack for Armageddon? What would be your current, you know, if I sent you from this room to plan, to prep?
Couple of books.
Books would be good. I always think, like, if I was on Desert Island Discs, I'd probably ask for the complete works of Dickens because it'd take me a long time to read that. And that would. I'm not a huge Dickens fan, but it's episodic and it's long. So that would keep me.
You'd learn to be a fan, wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe a twirl.
Yeah, a friend of mine eats only Twixes before his evening meal, and he seems to survive quite well.
What, all day?
Yeah.
All day Twixer.
Yeah, he's really slim, quite a sporty guy as well, but he just eats Twixes. Anyway.
What do you take? Apart from Dickens.
Beans
and Dickens.
Beans, Dickens and water. I mean, I would like to have kind of a fairly endless supply of booze, but my worry would be pretty quickly life would revolve around drinking booze. So I think if I had a big bag of golf balls, and I'm not very good at golf, but that would keep me busy for a good length of time.
Losing them and scrabbling to pick them up, and
the way we talk about escaping Armageddon would be like somewhere that you go and have no resource and never be able to leave. But I presume these tech billionaires are planning to go there and still have a gay old time. They're not just going to hold themselves up and eat beans and read Dickens.
Sounds pretty good.
I mean, I would.
I mean, I don't know specifically what they'll do for fun, like, you know, shooting the people at their door. They all seem to be looking forward to killing the poor with their bows and arrows.
Yeah. I saw this week that Bill Gates is projected by about 2020 to become the world's first trillionaire.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So is that he was giving his money away.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. He's becoming philanthropic publicly, but he's still raking it in.
Wow, that's a lot of beans.
I just want to quote from the story real quick, because this is kind of crazy. There's a second underground complex, a New Yorker writes, in a silo 25 miles away. As we pulled up, a crane loomed overhead, hoisting debris from deep below the surface. The complex will contain three times the living space of the original, in part because the garage will be moved to a separate structure. Among other additions, here's the answer to your question, Henry.
Yeah.
It will have a bowling alley and LED windows as large as French doors to create a feeling of openness.
Cool.
It will also have a data centre in it.
So, nice. So bowling and
Instagram.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, let's quickly go around the room then. Sensible precaution or madness gone mad? Henry.
Madness gone mad.
Tamlin.
Madness gone mad.
Dominic.
Yeah, madness gone mad.
Okay, we'll be back in a couple of seconds to talk about evil. What a wicked game you played to make me feel this way. Dominic Preston, Evil. It's coming to our consoles again. But when?
It's actually already out now. The new Resident Evil 7 came out on Tuesday the 25th of January. So it's out now after quite a few years in development. It's been about 5 or 6 years since the last sort of main entry in the series, Resident Evil 6, which did financially very well, but was critically very, very, very poorly received. And the fans weren't particularly keen on it either. And it's basically, so the Resident Evil series started off on the original PlayStation in the 90s. Classic sort of zombie survival horror. Emphasis on sort of, you know, very limited resources and fighting for your life all the way through. And as scary as it could be, given some very limited technology at the time compared to what we're used to. And the series got bigger and bigger, and it's the publisher Capcom's, it's their biggest franchise by a long, long way. But as it got bigger in scale, it also got sort of more action-packed, and you had to have bigger fight scenes,
is
more
that less scary, potentially?
And exactly, it just got less and less scary as it went on. And Resident Evil 6, in particular, has a reputation for just not being a horror game in the slightest. It's still sort of called a survival horror, but really, it's closer to action horror, and probably you could drop the horror off entirely. Like, the enemies are kind of horrific looking, you know, they're all bloody and pus soaked and things like that.
Those tech billionaires.
Exactly.
That'd be a good sort of in-game purchase if you could buy an underground complex and just wait out the Resident Evil apocalypse.
Just do some bowling.
Yeah, exactly.
Reading Dickens.
You've played 7, right? So what's it like?
I've played 7. So yeah, it's a very good game. It's not quite what it looks like, I think, from the way it's been marketed. So they've pushed a lot this idea of it's sort of a mixed message. It's a return to form, and it's an entirely new thing. which is a very hard angle to sell, I guess. So it's returned to form in that they're going back to the horror roots. They're making it scary again. It's a new thing in that they've picked a new perspective. It's now first-person camera, so you're sort of inside the head of the character rather than over their shoulder.
Yeah.
And it's also new because the series is best known for sort of zombies and monsters like that. This has sort of gone to a sort of decrepit Louisiana plantation, and you're up against basically kind of Texas Chainsaw Massacre-style hillbilly cannibals.
Nice.
There is sort of more to it than that, and as the plot goes on, it does sort of loosely tie back into the wider Resident Evil world, but okay. it's the kind of setting we haven't seen before, and the kind of that sort of the enemies are real characters, which is kind of new to the series, I guess, rather than just sort of faceless shambling hordes. So all that's new. What's kind of funny playing it is how much it just feels like a really traditional Resident Evil game, actually. You sort of the opening section, which is very similar to the demo they put out, that emphasizes the new stuff. You're sort of running and hiding a lot more than you used to. The sort of enemies you just can't kill, and all you have to do is try and get away from them rather than actually fight them. But by the time you're about 3 hours into the game, and it's about 10, 12 hours total, you've picked up a flamethrower, a shotgun, a pistol, you've got bags of ammo, and there's enemies you can kill, and you're just going around getting headshots and that kind of thing, and picking up exactly the same kind of resources the games are famous for. You're exploring a mansion, which at first felt like something very new, and then you realize, oh no, it's actually really similar to the mansion from the first game.
Okay.
And so it's this strange mix of trying to do a lot of new stuff while also really throwing back to the original game.
And it's the thing that people are getting excited about on this is that there's a VR compatible as well.
Yeah, so it's the first sort of full major game to be entirely PlayStation VR compatible. So it's just the PlayStation 4 version that's VR compatible. But you can play the entire game in PSVR. I cannot fathom why you would.
Right.
The main game is, for its faults, and it has a few faults, it is very, very scary pretty much all the way through.
Yeah.
And I just can't comprehend wanting to put
so is that
VR
is this similar
on.
To the kind of... I'm not a gamer, so forgive me. But is this similar to the sort of 3D movies, you know, don't really offer any greater immersion than a really well-made movie that's just in 2D?
No, so if you put the VR on, you have full control of the whole experience in VR. So, like I said, it's a first-person view, so you put it on, it will look like you're in that world.
Right.
You are then walking around, interacting. It is apparently a bit disorienting, because obviously it's that kind of VR challenge of your character is moving, but you in physical space are not moving.
Right.
Yeah.
And quite a few people have said the VR has made them feel a bit nauseous. Actually, the PR people, when sort of they sent over the review code, gave a warning, like, don't play the VR for too long. Do short doses. Start with it just on your TV screen first to get used to it. So I think the feeling is, for all of the hype about you can play the whole thing in VR, I'm not sure anyone would really want to.
Right.
A, from the it might just be too scary to actually be enjoyable, and B, just apparently it is a bit disorienting and choppy. And
I suppose VR is kind of more for the experiential games anyway, like, you know, the little bits I've done shooting aliens and things.
Yeah.
It's kind of fun. It's like going on a thrill ride. Again, to use a movie analogy, it's like the film Gravity as opposed to a more narrative story. It's kind of something you experience. Might be more successful than a narrative story like this sounds like.
Yeah, I think it's one of the challenges people are going to face with developing for VR on an ongoing basis. It's interesting to have a major game get ported into VR, but I don't know how often we're going to see that again, because I think it's just going to suit experiences built from the ground up for VR more. And yeah, generally more that kind of drop in. Like, you know, it's one thing to think, I'm going to sit on the sofa for 6 hours and play Resident Evil this weekend. It's another thing to think, I'm going to strap in a VR helmet and do 6 hours straight of VR. I don't think that's what anyone's looking
it's
for.
It's interesting all
it
the right hype
now.
It's getting, though. I haven't played it, but I've always found personally that games can scare me way more than films can.
Yeah.
I don't actually remember being... I remember seeing films that I've been, like, unsettled by or been a bit, like, jumpy.
Mm.
But I don't think I've ever actually been terrified watching a film. And then, like, I was telling Dom about this the other day, but I remember this awful PlayStation 1 game called... It was based on the Alien Resurrection movie.
Sure.
I bought that when I was, like, 15, and I absolutely crapped myself. Like, terrible PS1 graphics, but, like, the controller vibrates, and you don't know what's going on. And, like, it's just because you're in control, and you know that you basically have no control.
That's really interesting, because that's exactly what I was going to ask. Because, again, as a non-gamer, the thing that I really love about a great horror movie, say something like which again is more unsettling than particularly scary, but something like the Blair Witch Project.
What's
really scary about that is you don't have control.
Yeah.
It's a first person shooter, but the director's dictating where you are.
Mm. And no one has any guns.
It's a first person non shooter. But the bits where they're running, or the bit at the end, without wishing to give any spoilers, you want to look away and you can't, basically. Whereas with a game, I presume, in effect, you're the director because you're moving, particularly in as you described the change for this this game.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of an interesting thing in a way. You said with the Blair Witch Project and films like that, it's partly scary because you don't have control. Perversely, games like this can be scary because you do.
Right.
So I remember Alien Isolation, which is another Alien-linked game, and actually a big inspiration for the new Resident Evil, because it's also a sort of first-person horror where you have very limited resources, you can't ever kill the alien, really, you're just running and hiding from it. I'm a huge fan of the Alien films, but have seen them all too many times for them to scare me at all anymore. I went to play Alien Isolation, and I have never been as scared by anything in my entire life. It took me 2 months to finish the game, because I could only play it for about half an hour at a time, before it was just too much, and I had to walk away and leave it. The first time I actually encountered the alien, I just froze. Like, because I suddenly had this responsibility I had to deal with running away from this thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Dropped down from a ceiling panel, hissing at me. The game kind of like made a point of looking at a locker, like, go hide in that locker. And I sat there with the controller in my hands, just frozen. I just couldn't move my thumbs. And I just sat there watching as this thing walked towards me and killed me.
Would you have described that as an enjoyable experience?
Yeah, I'm really selling it, aren't I? Yeah. enjoyable isn't quite the word, but I mean, I love that it could make me feel that strongly. Resident Evil 7 doesn't quite get that far. It's not quite as intense an experience as that. Then maybe that's a good thing.
I always think it's like eating extremely hot food, though. It's a bit of a... it is enjoyable in a slightly different way, and one of the benefits, particularly of horror, is it's almost like a palate cleanser, because you know it's not real.
And it might make you shit yourself.
Similarities.
A couple of banal questions. This Resident Evil is available for PC, PlayStation, Xbox?
Yeah, exactly, those three.
And it's out right now. Usual sort of pricing, it's not particularly spectacularly expensive.
So it's out right now. I think at the moment, sort of around launch, the PC version's the cheapest. You can get that for about 35, and the console ones are about 42 on Amazon, last time we checked. It's the first third-party game to be part of the Microsoft Play Anywhere scheme, which means if you buy it for Xbox One or PC, you actually get to buy it on both of those with your save data being carried across.
Which is as it should be, but it's amazing how long it's taken to get there.
Exactly.
And that is quite a good thing.
And it's a big benefit, and that's definitely, you can see that being from their perspective, the selling point of please buy the Xbox version, not the PS4 version. The downside is you have to buy a digital copy from the official Microsoft store for that to work.
Right.
If you buy a physical copy, or if you buy it from Steam for PC, then you don't get that set up.
So Resident Evil will live up to the hype? Is it worth the wait? Because it's been quite a while coming.
It has been a while coming. I think if you're hoping for something entirely brand new and a really innovative, game-changing horror thing, it's not quite that. If you're a long-time fan of the franchise and looking for them to go back to something that's like the original games but done better with modern tech and with a few new twists, then it's a very good example of that.
Cool. Okay, let's very quickly go around the room then. Good game or terrible shame? Henry Brill.
Sounds like a good game.
It does sound that way, doesn't it? Tamlin?
Good game.
And Dominic, I think we know the answer here. But,
yeah, good game. I enjoyed it a lot.
Excellent. Thanks, guys. And thank you for listening to this edition of the UK Tech Weekly Podcast. Do get in touch to let us know your thoughts and opinions and to shake us down for cash. Or indeed, if you're interested in advertising, you can tweet us at UK Tech Podcast or email editor@idg.co.uk. We will be back next week with more informed opinion on the hottest topics in tech. So until then, find us on Acast, iTunes, SoundCloud and everywhere else. Give us a review and be nice to everybody you meet. Until next week, say goodbye, guys.
Bye.
UK Tech Weekly Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.